Well, last week I started talking about investing in this series on money and wealth, and we looked at the power of compound interest and the power of investing when it comes to creating wealth, and how especially starting early and just regularly investing week after week, month after month, year after year in investments that have a decent return on investment, a decent return of interest, that can build a lot of wealth over time. And today what I want to talk about is how to actually do that, like how you go about it, the practical steps of investing. And this is not going to be anything real earth-shattering. Probably a lot of you are familiar with some or most of this stuff, I would think. I'm not going to be talking about anything like picking individual stocks or day trading or anything like that. This is really, as Dave Ramsey says, investing like this is just flat out boring. It's just boring. You just do it, you set it up, and you basically set it and forget it, take a look at it once in a while. But it's very simple, it's very boring, there's nothing flashy or exciting about it really. But this is the way to do it, I think, if you want to get ahead in the long run. Now, I don't have much scripture in this part of the study today. And if I don't get to the end of it, I actually won't have any scripture. I do have scripture at the end, but if I'm going to be honest with myself, I probably won't get to the end because I normally don't. But I am going to console myself because there is a principle in scripture that all of this practical talk is going to show you how to implement in your life. So I do have one verse, one passage, and that is in Luke 19, 12 through 19. So basically everything I have to say today is going to teach you how to do what these two men did in this passage in 21st century America. Luke 19, 12 through 19. This is the parable of the pounds. I've mentioned this parable before in this series already. Luke 19 and verse 12. He said, therefore, this is the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds and said unto them, occupy till I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a message after him saying, we will not have this man to rule over us. And it came to pass that when he was returned, having received the kingdom, then he commanded these servants to be called unto him, to whom he had given the money, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. And we remember from last week, trading equals investing. It's the exact same thing. So he gave these men money, and he expected them to invest it. And when he came back, he wanted to see a return on his investment. Verse 16, then came the first, saying, Lord, thy pound hath gained 10 pounds. So he did a 10x investment. That's quite impressive, especially depending on the time period. And he said unto him, well, thou good servant, thou hast been faithful in a little thing. Let me read that again. Thou hast been faithful in very little, have thou authority over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Lord, thy pound hath gained 5 pounds. And he said likewise to him, be thou also over 5 cities. So he was impressed with the men that put their money to use, invested it, and grew it. And they were rewarded proportionally to how well they did. You turned your pound into 10 pounds, you have rule over 10 cities. You've done well with a little bit, you're going to be blessed with a lot. The man that did 5 with 1, that was good too. He was proportionally rewarded 5 cities. We know the story. The one man had the 1 pound, he hid it in the napkin, and the Lord was not happy with him. He said, you ought to at least put it in the bank and get some interest. I just noticed this today. I don't know why I hadn't noticed it before. In this parable, there were 10 people. In the Matthew 25 parable about the talents, there were only 3. One had 5, one had 2, one had 1. In this one, you had 10 people, but he only talks about 3 of them. One came back with 10, one came back with 5, one didn't do anything. We don't know about the rest. But if I had to speculate, I'd imagine that the rest of them probably did less than five, right? Because more than likely, if one of them would have done nine or one seven, he would have maybe talked about the ones that, you know, did better. I'm speculating a bit. But what this tells me is, if my speculation is correct, most people don't invest. Most people don't do much with what God's given them. Most people, you know, are just too busy with life. They're not concerned about it. They don't think about it. They don't have any money to invest because they spend it all or whatever. So I don't think there's anything new under the sun here. There's only one of them that really did well, that did a 10x investment. The other one did pretty well, and then the one was a bum, and we don't know anything about the other seven. So you want to be like the guy that did the 10x, if possible, and this is what I'm going to teach you today, how to practically do this. We're going to learn how to turn 1 pound into 10 pounds over decades. You're not going to turn 1 pound into 10 pounds in a year or two or three, not normally. And if you try to do that, you're probably going to lose your pound. You're not going to have any pounds. But you can turn one into 10 over the course of, you know, many years. The way to do this is, today, is in retirement accounts. This is the best vehicle that you have to invest to grow your money for the future is in retirement accounts. There are different type of retirement accounts. There's two main ones, and these are tax advantaged accounts. So you will get a break on taxes using these accounts. You either get a break on taxes up front, or you get a break on taxes at the end, one of the two, and we'll talk about both of these types here. The first one is a 401k. Now, a 401k, there's two types of those. There's a traditional 401k, and there's a Roth 401k. I'll talk about the Roth here in a minute. But right now I'm going to talk about the traditional 401k, but this part here applies to both. These are accounts that your employer sets up that you can then use. You can put money into them to invest in your retirement. It used to be companies would offer pensions, and companies realized that that's a really dumb idea, that bankrupts companies because you're paying all these people for years and years and years after they retire and all that. So most companies don't do pensions anymore. They leave it up to you, and that's what the 401k plan is. With a traditional 401k, the employee can make tax-deductible contributions. Currently, in 2025, he can make up to $23,500 a year in tax-free contributions to the 401k. Now, the really nice thing about the 401k is that the employer will also, in many cases, will match a certain percentage of whatever you contribute to your own 401k. So, usually they'll match a certain percentage. It could be a flat-out fee. They could say 50% up to the first $5,000, but usually what they'll do is maybe 50% or 100% of the first 3% or the first 6% or something like that. So in other words, if you contribute 6% of your gross income to the 401k and your employer does 100% match up to 6%, he will give you 6% in your account also, right? So if that 6% comes out to, just making numbers easy, if that's $1,000 a month, your employer will also put $1,000 a month into your account. Or if he does a 50% match, he would do $500 a month if you put $1,000 in there, whatever. That's free money that everybody, at a minimum, should be using your 401k and contributing to whatever amount you have to get the full match. Because that's an automatic 100% return on your investment. You put in $1,000, he puts in $1,000, you just made $1,000 for doing absolutely nothing. Regardless of what the market does, you just made 100% return on investment immediately. So you definitely want to use a 401k, at least up until the employer match. Now, in a traditional 401k, both the contributions and the account earnings grow tax-free until distributions are taken after age 59 and a half. Okay? Why they chose 59 and a half, I have no idea. Why wasn't it 60 or 59? I don't know, but it's 59 and a half. And then once you reach 59 and a half, you can start taking distributions. Distributions just means that you can start taking money back out of it. You can start living off the money that you've been saving all these years. You don't have to take it out at 59 and a half. You can leave it in there. You can keep working. Probably a good idea. Right now, the law is that you can you have to take mandatory distributions at age 73. You don't have to take it all out, I don't think, but you have to start taking a certain percentage of it out every year at age 73. But it grows tax-free up until then, and that's great because you can continue to compound your investment over time without paying taxes on it. If you just invested in the stock market using a brokerage account, and I'll get to this in a minute, if you did that, every time you sell a stock, say you buy some stock, you hold on to it for a few years, maybe you sell it and you want to buy something else, every time you sell it, you're paying capital gains tax on that increase. Now, that's usually less tax than you're paying on ordinary income. I'll talk about that later also. But you're still paying tax every time, so you're going to have less and less money to invest. Every time you make a trade, you're giving the government some of it, and now you have 15% less to invest in the next investment that you want. So the nice thing about the 401k is, even if you did do a lot of buying and selling within it, you never pay a dime of taxes until you start taking the money out after age 59 and a half. So you can go from one fund to another, you don't pay any tax. So that's an advantage. Now, some employers also offer what is called a Roth 401k. Roth is just named after the senator that came up with this idea around 25 years ago, early 2000s. So anytime you hear the word Roth, just think of it as after-tax money investment. So whether it's a Roth 401k or a Roth IRA, I'll get into IRAs here in a second, if it's a Roth, it means that you're contributing money to it that you've already paid taxes on. So there's no tax benefit up front to contributing to a Roth 401k. But it works similarly to a traditional 401k, except that the contributions, like I said, are made with after-tax income. Account earnings are tax-free as long as withdrawal rules are met. You have to be 59 and a half to withdraw, and you have to have been contributing to the Roth account for 5 years. So you can't, if, for instance, if you started contributing to a Roth when you were 58, you can't then withdraw when you're 60. You'd have to wait until you're 63. You had to have been contributing 5 years before you can withdraw it without paying tax on the growth of it. The contributions can be taken out tax-free at any time because you've already paid taxes on them. There may be some stipulations as to what you can take them out for. I don't remember all the details on that. But the great thing about a Roth is once you put the money in it, you've already paid tax on the money to start with. Once you put the money in there, you never pay a dime of taxes on it ever again. So it can grow and grow and grow and compound. And when you turn 59 and a half, you can take as much money as you want out, and you're never going to pay a dime of taxes if the government doesn't change the rules. If they change the rules, you may pay tax on it now, and then you may pay tax on it when you take it out in 30 years from now. Or you may not take any of it out because they may just confiscate it all. Who knows? I mean, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. But assuming that they play by the rules, which that's kind of an assumption that the government's going to play by the rules, but assuming that they do, you're never going to pay tax on the money when you take it out, which is great because you'll know exactly how much you have and you don't have to worry about tax rates. You don't have to worry about what tax bracket I'm in. You don't have to worry about if the tax rates have gone way up or whatever. You already know whatever's in there is yours. You don't have to share it with Uncle Sam and all of the leeches out there that he likes to fund. Now, there's also, this wouldn't apply to very many people, but there's also what is called a one-participant 401k. It's otherwise known as a self-employed 401k, a solo 401k, or an individual 401k. This would be specifically for small business owners, solopreneurs, as you want to call them, that they are the only employee of their business, right? So just a one-man show, you know, if he's a handyman or a plumber or an electrician or a real estate agent or something like that, and he is his entire business, or his spouse, right? So it can also include your spouse if the spouse works for the business. But that's it. You can have no other employees besides yourself or your spouse. These things can be a really great asset for a self-employed person like that, because they work just like a regular 401k, except the business owner can contribute both as an employee and the employer, which means that he can contribute up to a maximum of $70,000 per year, that's in 2025, depending on his income. So as an employee, he can contribute $23,500 per year. As long as he makes $23,500 per year, he can contribute up to 100% of his income. And then as the employer, I think it's 25% of his income that the employer can put in. I mean, he is both. He's the employee and employer. But as an employer, he can put in 25%. So you'd have to make some money. I mean, you got to get up into the, you know, 100, probably, I don't know what you'd have to do to max out the 70, probably close to $200,000 or something like that. But, you know, for a self-employed person that makes decent money like that, he could actually be socking away $70,000 a year into a 401k program, tax-free if it's a traditional 401k, or after-tax if it's a Roth 401k. There's also a SEP 401k, which is for self-employed business owners that have more than one employee, that, you know, small businesses that would have employees. There's also what's called a 403b, which is for people that work for nonprofits. It's like a 401k only for if you work for a nonprofit. So it works basically the same way. Now, the other major retirement account is an IRA. You may have heard of an IRA before. That stands for Individual Retirement Account. It's similar to a 401k, but there are a few differences with it. IRAs can be traditional, which means that you fund them with pre-tax money, or they can be Roth, which means you fund them with after-tax contributions. So when I say when you fund a traditional 401k or IRA with pre-tax money, what that means in practice for most people that are employees is with the 401k, let's say you're putting nothing into your 401k and your paycheck is $4,000 a month. I'm just going to make up numbers, right? And you decide, I want to start funding my 401k and I'm going to get really busy with it. I'm going to put $1,000 a month into this thing. Well, that means that your employer is not going to take out taxes on that $1,000 a month, right? So you're not going to be taxed on that. So if, say, you're in a 25% tax bracket, instead of you paying $1,000 per month in taxes, right, because 25% of $4,000 would be $1,000. So instead of paying $1,000 a month in taxes, you're only going to pay on $3,000 of your income instead of $4,000, because you're not going to pay tax on that $1,000. So you're going to save the money that you would have paid in taxes on that $1,000, which would be $250 if you're in a 25% tax bracket. So essentially, when you put that $1,000 a month into your 401k, you just saved yourself $250 a month in taxes. So rather than your income being $3,000 a month, because you're putting $1,000 into your 401k, instead of it being $3,000 a month, your income would actually be $3,250 per month, right? So you just saved $250. I hope that made sense. That makes sense? Maybe it made sense, maybe it didn't. You can listen to it again if you didn't catch it that time. The point is, you don't pay tax on the money that you put in the 401k. That's all. The same thing would be with an IRA, except since it's not through your employer, if you contributed that $1,000 a month to your IRA, which you actually couldn't do, you can only do $7,000 a year, but if you contributed money to the IRA, at the end of the year when you do your taxes, you put down on your tax return how much you put into your traditional IRA, and then you don't pay tax on that amount, and you end up getting a refund back on the taxes that you paid throughout the year. That's if you're an employee. If you're self-employed, then, you know, you just wouldn't have to pay that amount of taxes. Okay, so an IRA is set up, one of the biggest differences, it's set up by the account holder himself. That's you. instead of your employer. Your employer sets up the 401k. Your employer manages the 401k. He pays the fees in the 401k. He takes care of all the regulatory stuff. There's all kinds of stuff that goes into it. I was just looking into a solo 401k, and there's all kinds of regulations that you have to do, and paperwork and stuff. You got to keep all these records and all this stuff. The employer takes care of all that stuff. So like I said, being an employee is so easy compared to being self-employed in many cases. With the IRA, you set it up yourself. You take care of it yourself. But it's simple to do. There's nothing. You don't have to keep a bunch of paperwork and records and all that. You can set up an IRA, just make contributions to it. You can mail in a check. You can have it direct debited from your account. You can have it come out of your account every 2 weeks or every month or whatever you want to do. It's pretty simple. The other big difference is that an IRA, you don't get matching funds from your employer, right? There is no match with an IRA, whereas with a 401k, usually they will match part of what you put in. The other big difference between an IRA and a 401k is that the contribution limits to an IRA are a lot lower than a 401k. Remember, a 401k, you can put a maximum of $23,500 per year into it tax-free. An IRA is only $7,000 per year in 2025. It goes up a little bit every year. But some of the benefits of one of the benefits of an IRA is that you normally have more investment options with it than a 401k. With your 401k, you're stuck. You get the 401k your company has, and that's your only option. Within that 401k, there are different types of funds that you can buy, but you're still generally limited to a certain number of funds that you can buy into. With an IRA, you'd want to do the research before you open it, but a lot of them, they're wide open. You know, if you take out an IRA, say with Fidelity, I'm pretty sure about this, that you not only have access to Fidelity's mutual funds, I'll get into what mutual funds are later, but you also can just buy stocks and ETFs. I'll get into what ETFs are later also. But you can buy whatever you want, just like you were in an individual brokerage account. You can buy whatever you want. It's just within that retirement vehicle. So the only difference between that and just going, getting a brokerage account and buying stocks would be you're not paying tax every time you sell one of your stocks. And then there is the brokerage account, which I didn't have this in the outline, but I thought I would mention this as well. This is not what people would call retirement savings necessarily. Usually when people talk about retirement accounts, they're talking about these tax-advantaged accounts like 401ks and IRAs. A brokerage account is just basically a bank account that allows you to buy and sell stocks within it. It's not a normal bank account. I mean, if you want to open up a bank account, you don't open up a brokerage account. Nobody does that. But it's essentially, that's what it is. But it's non-tax advantaged, which means that when you buy stocks, ETFs, mutual funds, whatever you buy within this brokerage account, like I said, you are going to pay taxes every time you sell something that you own in there and you have a gain. Or you can save on taxes if you have a loss. A brokerage account, now examples of these would be like Charles Schwab, E-Trade, Fidelity, Robinhood. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them out there. They're usually called discount brokerage accounts. The nice thing about these is they're versatile. So you can do whatever you want in there. You can buy and sell anytime you want. It's just sky is the limit. There's no penalty. You can take the money out anytime you want. You can put a bunch of money into a brokerage account. You can buy some stocks. If something comes up and your HVAC unit blows up in your house, right, and you need $10,000, you can sell your stock. You can withdraw the money probably like the next day and boom, buy your HVAC unit or whatever you want. The only thing you want to remember is when you sell those stocks, put back 15% or so, depending on, I'll get into that right now, but put back some money because you're going to owe tax on that stock that you just sold. So you don't want to forget about that, or you're going to have a big tax bill at the end of the year, and then you're going to be scrambling. So you always want to have that tax account set up. So in a brokerage account, the gains are taxed in what you call, as what you call, capital gains. You ever heard, anybody heard of capital gains? You probably heard of capital gains tax before, right? What a capital gains tax is if you own an asset, it could be a house, or it could be a stock, or it could be other things too, I suppose. If that thing, that asset that you own, if it appreciates in value during the time that you own it, then you have to pay capital gains tax on the appreciation when you sell it. If it's a house, for instance. Now, I don't think this generally applies to primary residency. So if it's the house that you buy and you live in, you won't pay capital gains when you sell it. But if you had an investment property, if you had a home that you bought to rent out, if you had a vacation home, something like that, say you buy that house for $200,000, you hold on to it for 10 years, you sell it for $300,000, you're going to owe capital gains on the $100,000 of gain that you had on that. It works the same way with stocks. If you buy a stock, say you buy $1,000 worth of Apple stock, you hold on to it for a few years, it's worth $1,500, you're going to owe capital gains tax on that $500 gain that you got from your stock sale. Now, capital gains taxes are broken up into two different kinds. Okay? There's long-term capital gains and there's short-term capital gains. And these are taxed very differently. A short-term capital gain is something, when you sell an asset that you've owned for less than 1 year. Okay? That's a short-term capital gain. A long-term capital gain is an asset that you've owned for more than 1 year. Okay? Especially if you have a brokerage account and you're buying stocks, mutual funds, ETFs, whatever. Whatever you're buying there in the stock market, you always want to consider this, because if you sell it in less than a year, you're going to owe short-term capital gains, which is going to be a lot more taxes, typically, depending on your income. Short-term capital gains are taxed as what is called ordinary income, just like your wages at your job. That's ordinary income, okay? So when you have a short-term capital gain, so if you bought a stock and you sold it in less than a year, you're going to pay whatever income tax your marginal income tax rate is. So if you're in a 12% bracket, you're going to pay 12%. If you're in a 22% or 24%, 28%, whatever your tax bracket is, that's the amount of tax you're going to pay on that capital gain. Now, if you're in a low tax bracket, if you don't make very much money, you know, that's not such a big deal. If you're in a higher tax bracket, you know, you're going to get whacked at 22, 24%, something like that. You're going to be paying quite a bit of tax on that stock sale. Long-term capital gains are, most people are probably the average person is going to pay 15% for long-term capital gains if you own it for more than a year. And it's actually broke down into, there's three categories. There's 0% long-term capital gains, there's 15% and 20%. If you're single and you make under $48,000 a year, you pay $0 in long-term capital gains. So that can be a great deal. If you're making $48K, I mean, you're not going to have like huge amounts of money to be investing in the stock market necessarily, but you could do all the investing you want, you're going to pay a dime in taxes. If you're married, that's $96,000. So if you're married, your family, your household income is $96,000 or less, you're not paying any long-term capital gains if you buy and sell stocks or real estate or anything else. If you're single and your income is between $48,000 and $533,000, I imagine probably most of us are within that range, at least, you know, under the upper end of the range anyway, I would think, you're at 15% long-term capital gains. If you're married, it's $96,000 to $600,000, 15% long-term capital gains. That's going to be most people. And then if you are single and you make over $533K, or if you're married, you make over $600K, your long-term capital gains is going to be 20. But for most people, you're probably looking at 15% long-term capital gains. So if you buy a stock and you hold it for more than a year, chances are you're going to owe 15%. Or if your income is lower, you might owe nothing, which would be really nice. Zero tax rate's my favorite one. So a brokerage account can be a way to save for retirement. It just, you know, it just depends on what you want to do. But you don't get to put tax-free money into it. You don't save on taxes up front. So there are advantages to the, you know, the 401k and the IRA, of course, for retirement. The other advantage is if you are an undisciplined person, definitely go with the IRA and the 401k because you can't take the money out. If you're undisciplined and you're looking at, oh, I've got $50,000 in my brokerage account, I'd really like to have a new whatever, sell those stocks, pay that capital gains, and I'm going to buy that thing. You can't do that with an IRA or 401k. Well, you can, but you pay all the tax with the traditional, and you'll pay a 10% penalty. And so most people that have, you know, more than like three brain cells to rub together aren't going to do that to buy themselves a new four-wheeler or whatever, right? Whereas, you know, some people, if they could just hit the sell button in their E-Trade account, they might be tempted to do that. All right, so where to invest your money. So before I talk about where, just briefly, remember, you want to invest 15% of your gross income before taxes. That's the figure that you want to get to. If you're not there right now, start where you are, and we'll talk about budgeting here in a week or so. Get your budget under control, get your spending under control, and then you can start ramping that up till you get to that 15% per year into your retirement account. Now, that's only if you're debt-free except for your house, right? If you have any debt except for your house, forget about investing in retirement, pay off all that debt except for your house, and then do the 15%. Well, actually, pay off the debt, get a 3 to 6 month emergency fund saved up, 3 to 6 months of expenses, not your income, your expenses, right? Your income and your expenses should be quite different. Expenses would be a lot less than your income, or should be anyway. Get that emergency fund set up, then do the 15%. So out of debt except for the house, 3 to 6 months emergency fund, then you start funding the 15% into retirement. So the best place to start is taking advantage of your company's 401k, if they have one, especially if they do a match. Right, so if your company does a match, this is a no-brainer. No-brainer. Do this. At least do the match because it's 100% return on your investment immediately. You can't beat it. You're not going to get that anywhere. Now, believe it or not, using a plain old company-sponsored 401k is what most millionaires do, at least half of millionaires. It's their primary thing that they do to become a millionaire. The primary thing that half of millionaires did to become a millionaire is just this simple, boring thing of putting money in your 401k every paycheck. That's it. Here's a quote for you. This is from Dave Ramsey's Baby Steps Millionaires. There's going to be a little bit of information in this quote that is not pertinent. I just included the whole quote because I don't like putting dot, dot, dot in the quote because then people are like, well, what's in the dot, dot, dot? Why don't you put everything in there? So some of this stuff is not important, but I'll draw your attention to the important part. Get my glasses on for this one. As table 22C indicates, 47% of millionaires in the study, that's the National Study of Millionaires, 47% of millionaires in the study ranked the employer-sponsored retirement plan first. That's a 401k. They ranked at number one in when he says, you know, what is your favorite wealth-building tool? He asked all these millionaires. Almost half of them said, the company 401k. That's my number one wealth-building tool right there. While another 30% ranked it second. As a result, this tool ended up with the largest importance factor on the list at 6.17. Like I said, that is, don't worry about what that means. It's unimportant. When combined with information from Figure 22A, the research indicates that the vast majority of millionaires used a company plan to build wealth and believe that it is the primary tool for reaching financial independence. Likewise, the millionaires also see the importance of investing outside of the company. Nearly two-thirds of respondents ranked this as either first or second, which produced a weighted importance score of 5.84. Again, not important. In the research interviews, millionaires mentioned taking advantage of IRAs and ETFs. ETFs are exchange-traded funds. I'll explain what they are here in a minute. They mentioned taking advantage of IRAs and ETFs, specifically low-cost index funds. I'll talk about what they are as well, as some of the keys to growing their wealth. Okay, so these millionaires aren't investing in some fancy hedge fund. They don't have some personal broker that's buying and selling individual stocks for them and all this stuff. They're just doing the normal old boring thing of putting money in their 401k, picking a good mutual fund in that, and just doing it week after week after week after week. And 20 years later, boom, you're a millionaire. It's simple and boring. Now, if your employer offers a Roth 401k, remember Roth is you contribute to it with after-tax money, right? If they offer a Roth 401k, you want to consider doing this because it will likely cause you to have more money in the end once it's all said and done and all the taxes are paid. I will give you an example of that here in just a minute. As I mentioned before, your contributions that you make to a Roth are with after-tax dollars. The contributions and the earnings then grow tax-free, and when you begin to take distributions, you don't pay any tax, right? So I've already been over that. I've already said this as well, that this assumes that the government does not change the rules, right? Because they could. As Carlton Moore said, and I'll talk about him in just a second, but as he said, a Roth is not even old enough to rent a car by itself yet. It's not even 25 years old, right? So who knows what might happen long term with Roth? You know, some of these criminals and thieves in Washington, D.C. might decide they want to tax it anyway after they promised you that they wouldn't. But if they don't do that, you know, it's a pretty good deal. Now, for those with high incomes, a traditional 401k will save a lot of money in taxes up front that could be invested in a Roth IRA. If you have a lower income, you're not paying very much tax anyway, so it doesn't really matter so much. But if you have a higher income and you're in a higher tax bracket, using a traditional IRA can save you, you know, a significant amount of money every month and every year. But I still think, based on the numbers that I've run here, it still appears to me that using a Roth 401k, if your employer offers it, and all employers don't offer the Roth 401k yet, they probably will, you know, in the future. But if they offer that Roth 401k, I still think you're better off using the Roth in the long run. Even though you won't save any taxes up front, in the long run, you will end up better off. And I will give you the numbers here, and I'm going to see if your eyes roll over into the back of your heads or not. I'm going to try to make this plain. It's not rocket science, but I know it's kind of hard to follow sometimes. Okay, so let me give you an example. For instance, if a man has an effective tax rate of 25%, that's not one of the brackets, but you know, you got 22%, you got 24%, you got some other ones. Maybe you're you know, between brackets, so some of your money's in one and some of your money's in the other, or whatever. So let's just say for the sake of an example, your effective tax rate is 25%. And you're contributing the maximum of $23,500 per year into your traditional 401k. If you did that, you would save $5,875 per year in taxes. Okay, so if you did that, you maxed that thing out, $23,500 per year, like $2,000 a month, basically. If you did that, you're going to save yourself almost $6,000 a year in taxes. Okay, now, if you took that $5,875 that you saved in taxes and put it into a Roth IRA, this is how you can use this tax savings to increase your nest egg. If you just blow the tax savings that you got, if you put the money into the traditional IRA, you save $6,000 in taxes, and then you go out and blow $6,000 on fun, well, then you may as well use the Roth because that, you know, you're just blowing the money. But if you're trying to maximize your investment, you know, this is how you do it. You take that saved tax money and you put that into a Roth IRA, after tax money. So say you invest that $5,875 per year into a Roth IRA. And by the way, I haven't told you this yet, but you can invest in both a 401k and an IRA at the same time. okay? You can have multiple IRAs. You could have an IRA for every outfit that you have. You could have an IRA for every day of the week. The only thing is, you can only contribute $7,000 a year in total to all of your IRAs. You could have seven IRAs and you could put $1,000 a year into each one of them. But that's all you can do. You can't put $7,000 into each one. It'd be nice if they allowed you to do that, but they won't. But you can max out the 401k and then you can also max out the IRA. So you can do that. And I'll talk about that later, depending on what your income is and so on. Okay, so using this strategy, you maxed out the traditional 401k, $23,500, and then you put the tax savings, the $5,875, you put that into a traditional IRA. Using this strategy, you could invest $29,375 per year and have the same out-of-pocket expense as if you had invested $23,500 in a Roth 401k. Remember, there's no upfront tax savings to a Roth 401k. So if you put the $23,500 into a Roth, you would have the same out-of-pocket expense as if you put the $23,500 into a traditional 401k and put the $5,875 tax savings into a Roth IRA. So in other words, you have now invested $29,000 for the same out-of-pocket amount that you would have invested, that you would have spent if you had invested the $23,000 into the Roth, right? I hope that makes sense. Because you saved money on taxes and then invested that money, okay? If a man used this strategy for 30 years, say from age 30 to 60, for example, the extra $5,875 per year that was saved on taxes and invested in the Roth IRA would be worth about a little more than $1.1 million, assuming a 10% annual return. So you would have literally made $1.1 million in just taking the tax money that you saved using the traditional IRA and investing that saved tax money over 30 years. You'd have made $1.1 million just using that saved tax money. You think, well, that's awesome. I just made over $1 million from money that would have gone to Uncle Sam, and now I've got $1 million where I would have had nothing because it would have gone to Uncle Sam. That's true, but there's a caveat here. Now, his investment in the traditional 401k, the one that he was putting the $23,500 a year into, basically the $2,000 a month, his investment in the traditional 401k would be worth $4.4 million after 30 years, assuming a 10% average return rate. So his total investments, his traditional 401k that he put the $23,500 in his Roth IRA that he put the $5,875 of tax savings in, those total investments after 30 years would be worth over $5.5 million. $4.4 for the traditional 401k, $1.1 for the Roth IRA. However, the $4.4 million in his traditional 401k would be taxed when he took distributions at age 60. Okay, so when he gets to age 60, now he's got to pay the tax man. He saved all the money all these years along the way. He's saving like $6,000 a year from the tax man, but now it's time to pay the piper on that traditional 401k. Now, if the $4.4 million was taxed at 30% over the course of the next 20 years, we'll say. So say he starts collecting at 60 and he lives until 80, so he starts taking out it over 20 years. Even if you did that, you'd still have an income of $220,000 a year. So you're still going to be in a pretty high tax bracket. And in 30 years from now, who knows what the tax bracket might be. But let's just say, if you take it out in a lump sum, you're going to pay huge taxes, obviously, right? I mean, $4.4 million, you're going to be in the highest bracket, and you're going to be paying through the nose. But even if you took it out, you know, periodically over 20 years, you're still going to be in a pretty high tax bracket. So say you were taxed at 30%, which is, you know, in 30 years from now is probably not unreasonable. It could be worse than that. But say you're taxed at 30%. You'd only have about a little over $3 million left after taxes, which is, you know, obviously you're doing well. This means that your investment would be worth a total of about $4.2 million after taxes. That'd be, you'd have $3.1 million in your IRA, your Roth, I'm getting these mixed up. You'd have $3.1 in your traditional 401k after you paid the taxes, and you'd have $1.1 in your Roth IRA that's already been taxed, right? So you got a total of $4.2 million. I realize I'm using big numbers here. I was just maxing out the IRA. The numbers would work regardless of, you know, what you're putting in there, and I mean, you wouldn't have to have these huge amounts of money. The numbers would still work. Now, if his effective tax rate was 35% instead of 30, which is, you know, certainly possible in 30 years from now, if it was 35%, he'd have a total of about $3.9 million after taxes. If his effective tax rate was 40%, he'd have a total of about $3.7 million after taxes, right? So you're paying out a lot of money here in taxes on that traditional 401k. But despite the taxes saved up front, it appears to me from my calculations here that investing in only a Roth 401k would still be more profitable after the taxes are paid in the end. If the same man invested the max of $23,500 per year in his Roth 401k, that's after taxes, so he gets no tax benefit. He's not saving any tax money now. He's already paid taxes on that money. He's putting the $23,500 max into his Roth 401k, his investment would have grown to a little over $4.4 million over 30 years if he had a 10% average return. But this would all be tax-free money when he starts taking distributions at age 60. So he's got the $4.4 million, and he's not going to pay any taxes on it. Okay. So remember what happened when he did the traditional 401k, and he saved the tax money and invested in the IRA and all that? Remember that I say only as if it's a minuscule amount of money. He only had like $4.2 million left at 30% tax rate, or he only had $3.9 million at a 35% tax rate, or he only had $3.7 million at a 40% tax rate. Well, if he would have done the Roth, he'd have the whole 4.4. So by using the Roth 401k, after all the taxes are paid, he would end up with between $221,000 and $664,000 more dollars than if he used the traditional 401k and invested the saved tax money in the Roth IRA. So I went through all those calculations and all that stuff just to tell you that it looks to me, based on depending on what tax bracket you're in now and what tax bracket you think you'll be in the future and all that, but it looks to me that higher income earners would probably be better off just going with a Roth in the first place. Forget about the tax savings now, even though I love to save taxes anytime I can, but it appears that you'll end up with more in the end if you went with a Roth. But regardless which way you went, you could probably get by if you had between $3.7 and $4.4 million at age 60. You'd probably be okay either way, you know, whether you had one or the other. Chances are you're not going to be eating beans and rice for the next 20 years if you had that kind of money. Okay, so if your employer doesn't offer a Roth 401k, then I recommend opening up a Roth IRA for you and another one for your spouse if need be in order to invest 15% of your gross income. Remember, the contribution limits for an IRA, whether it's a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA, are $7,000 a year. Now, you can get a traditional and you can get a Roth, but again, you can only put a total of $7,000 in both of them combined. So you can't do 7 in one and 7 in the other. You could do 3.5 in one and 3.5 in the other. You could do 1 in one and 6 in the other, but you can only do a maximum of 7. But your spouse can have one, and you can have one, and you can put $7,000 each into them. So you can do a total of $14,000 if you're married in an IRA, whether a Roth or a traditional. Now, here's what Dave Ramsey recommends to do, because he's a proponent of the Roth IRA or 401k. And if your employer doesn't offer a Roth 401k, then that's why you open up the Roth for yourself and possibly for your spouse, so that you can take advantage of the employer match in the 401k, get that 100% return, get that free money, and then put everything else in a Roth IRA so that you're getting the tax advantage, so your money is going to grow tax-free, and when you take it out someday, you're not going to owe any taxes, and it's going to be better off in the long run. That's what Ramsey recommends. Okay, so first, he says, contribute the minimum percentage of your gross income into your company's 401k. The minimum percentage that's required to get the full employer match. So maybe 6%, for instance, because that's free money. Okay, so you work for a company, you've got an IRA, or you've got a 401k, and it's a regular 401k, a traditional 401k, and they offer to match whatever you put into it up to 6% of your income. So you put in 6%, they give 6%, right? So start off with that. You put 6% in that traditional 401k because you get the free money. Then go over to your and possibly even your spouse's Roth IRA and then contribute the remaining part of your income until you get up to 15% of your gross income in the Roth IRAs. Now, if you make a lot of money and you've maxed out those IRAs at $14,000 and you're still not high, you still haven't got to the 15% of your income yet, then go back to your 401k and finish it up there. So if you're not able to get to 15% of your gross income using your Roth IRAs, then go back and fund your 401k with enough until you get to 15% of your gross income. Now, just so you know, if your income is higher than $93,333 per year, then you would have to go into your 401k. Okay, so 15% of $93,000 a year is $14,000. So if your income is higher than $93,000, you're going to have to do more than just Roth IRAs. You're going to have to go to the 401k. Now, you would have the matching part first, so, you know, but anyway, if you're a higher income earner, you're going to have to use both of them to get to that 15% of your income. Now, inside your 401k and your IRA, you want to invest in good mutual funds. This is what Ramsey says, averaging 12% per year over the long term. So up until this point, I haven't really talked about what to invest in. I've just talked about the vehicle that you're going to use to invest. That is the IRA and the 401k. But within the IRA and the 401k, you have, in most of them, you have mutual funds. And you can invest in different mutual funds. And those are the funds you're going to buy. And then your money is going to be in the stock market through those mutual funds. Now, you're going to have different options in your 401k, your IRA, it's probably more wide open. But your 401k, you're going to have a limited number of options. In some of these 401ks, they'll have funds that are called like the 2035 fund, the 2040 fund, the 2045, the 2050, the 2060 fund. That means whatever year you are planning to retire, you'd buy that fund, and then they change the ratio of the investments as you get closer to retirement. That's the idea anyway, where you'd have less risky stocks as you get closer to retirement. You'd have, you know, more bonds and so-called safe investments anyway. Investing in U.S. bonds, I don't think is very safe anymore. But anyway, so he recommends, you know, looking at those mutual funds, you can look at the track record of those mutual funds. You click on each of them, and you can see what they've done over the last 10 years or so, and find one that has done like 12% per year over the long run. That's what he recommends, Ramsey. And then he recommends putting 25% into each of the four categories of mutual funds. Now, I guess let me stop. I told you I would tell you what a mutual fund is. So a mutual fund is a fund that has within it a bunch of different stocks, right? So it is a fund that's managed by some hopefully smart people out there. And this smart guy comes up with the Chad Fund. Okay, I'm not the smart guy. Let's use another name. I'm not the smart guy. Comes up with a Don Fund. Don's a smart guy. Comes up with a Don Fund. And Don does all the research. And Don finds out, you know, I have found 100 companies that are really great companies. They have great earnings. They have great balance sheets. They have great history. I'm going to buy these 100 companies, these 100 stocks, and I'm going to put them in the Don Fund, okay? And then you can buy the Don Fund, and you just bought stock in all of those 100 companies. Because when you buy the Don Fund and you put $1,000 in the Don Fund, that $1,000 gets split up and it buys a little piece of each of those 100 companies in the Don Fund. Okay, that makes sense? That's what a mutual fund is, okay? I told you I'd tell you what an ETF is. I'll get to ETFs later, but I may as well explain that too. ETF is a similar thing. It stands for Exchange Traded Fund, and it's the same kind of idea. Now, typically with an ETF, a lot of times, they will be a bunch of companies that are similar put together sometimes. Like, for instance, there's a gold mining ETF. Ticker symbol GDX. That's got pretty much all of the big gold mining companies are in that fund. So if you buy a share of GDX, that ETF, you've bought a share in a bunch of different gold mining companies, right? Or you can buy an ETF of foreign currencies, right? You could buy an ETF for the euro. And if you buy that ETF, you have bought euros or Japanese yen. Or, I mean, there's even a Bitcoin ETF now. You can buy an ETF, you can just go in your brokerage account, you buy the ETF, and it was as if you bought Bitcoin. Although you didn't have to go through all the hassle and rigmarole of buying Bitcoin and getting all the keys and wallets and all this stuff that goes into that. There's also ETFs that follow other funds. There's ETFs that follow, like, the S&P 500. I'll get into this later, but the S&P 500 is an index of 500 of the most valuable companies in America. And they have to be, like, do $20 billion a year in revenue, and there's, you know, a whole bunch of criteria there. And they're included in the S&P 500. And you can buy ETFs, exchange-traded funds, that mirror the S&P 500. They have shares of each of those 500 companies in the proportions that the S&P 500 has. So if you buy a share of that ETF, you just bought a little piece of each of the companies in the S&P 500. It mirrors it and follows it, okay? So mutual funds and ETFs, that's what they are. They're a fund that's made up of a bunch of stocks. And instead of having to buy a bunch of stocks and watch a bunch of stocks and trade and sell when one company goes down and I don't think I should be in this company anymore, I'm going to sell that, I'm going to buy a different company, some smart guy like Don takes care of it for you. He gets rid of the one company and puts another company in the ETF. You don't have to do any of that stuff, right? All right. So here's what Ramsey recommends. Put 25% into each of four categories of mutual funds. The first is growth. This is what they typically call this, growth. That means mid-cap. When you see mid-cap or growth or mid-cap, that means medium-sized companies. So, like, not Apple, not Google, not Microsoft, not NVIDIA, you know, not, you know, these huge companies, but mid-sized companies. You know, good-sized companies, but still, you know, mid-sized. So put 25% in growth, which are mid-cap companies, 25% in growth and income, which are large-cap. These are the big companies, right? So some of the ones that I just mentioned, you know, really large companies. Put 25% in aggressive growth. This is small-cap. These are smaller companies that have a potential to grow quickly, right? Because a lot of times small companies, you know, there's a lot of potential there, right? If you'd have bought Amazon in, you know, 1999 or something, you know, you had a lot of growth to go, right? So these are more risky, but there's a lot more potential reward with them. And then 25% international. So that's companies that are non-U.S. companies, you know, in emerging markets or other countries that may not have the same risks that the American market has. So if something happens to the American market, maybe, you know, the international is still doing okay or vice versa. So that's what Ramsey recommends. And you want to look at these mutual funds. You want to see their track record. Find one that has consistently done 12% over the long run, over 10 years or more. And then split up your money in those four categories. One thing you can do to look at these funds that I think is a great idea, I got this from Carlton Moore, I'm going to talk about him next, is get the ticker symbols for these mutual funds. Because every stock out there has a ticker symbol. It's like a 3 or a 4-letter abbreviation, if you will, for that company. So, like I said, GDX, right? That ETF, the ticker symbol is GDX. So if you go into your account and you punch in GDX, it'll show up with the VanEck Gold Miners Company or whatever. That's the full name of it. And you click on that and you can look at how it's done. Well, so if you go into Google Finance, you can get there by going to finance.google.com or just Google Finance and you'll find it. Go to Google Finance and you can punch in any stock ticker symbol, any mutual fund ticker symbol, any ETF, any index, you know, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, the Dow, you know, whatever. You can punch in anything in there and you'll see a chart of it and you'll see what it's done over its lifetime, however long that's been. And then there's a place where you can click compare to right below that. And so maybe you pull up your mutual funds. So you go in your 401k, maybe you have 20 mutual funds, 10 mutual funds to choose from, for instance. So you've got ABC Mutual Fund. This is a growth fund or something like that. So you pick ABC Mutual Fund, your ticker symbol's ABC. You go into Google Finance, you punch in ABC and you click on it, and you see this chart thing and you see what it's done. Click the compare to button and then put in the S&P 500. Just type in S&P 500, click on that. And it will show you your mutual fund and the S&P 500 on the same chart. And you can see how they've compared to each other. Now, if you click on that mutual fund and you see that it has underperformed the S&P 500, forget about it. Don't buy that piece of crap. Why would you do that? You know? So compare everything that you see in your 401k to the S&P 500 and see how it did. If it's not keeping up with the S&P, don't waste your time with it. And that brings me into the next point, and that is what Carlton Moore, founder of Kingdom Wealth Building, what he recommends. Okay, let's see how far we're going to get here with. We can at least get through Carlton anyway. I don't know if I'll get past Carlton or not. But Carlton, he's a guy, I never heard of him before, but he had put on a presentation at Crescent Lake here in town, at one of the local churches in town. And my wife and I were invited to it. It was a 3-night presentation. This was only maybe a few weeks ago. And this guy, he's a younger-ish guy, probably in his late 30s now. He retired at 31. He was a stock analyst, started out as a stock analyst, and then he went and worked at Google, in sales in Google. But anyway, the whole time, he made good money, and he was wise with it, and he was just socking away every penny that he could into the stock market, and he did really well picking stocks. I don't recommend this. Most people don't do really well at it. I wouldn't even try it myself. But he did really well at it. He averaged a 40% per year return over 10 years, which is astronomical, right? That's why he retired at 31. Anyway, I don't know. He's obviously a multimillionaire. I don't know how much money he has. He doesn't say. But he's a professing Christian man. And so now he's made it his mission in life to go around and teach Christians and churches how to invest their money. Now, he doesn't teach you how to pick stocks. He does mention that at the very end, how you can find stocks like that. But his main thing is just simple, boring stuff. It's really simple. It's really boring. And this is what he recommends. Like Ramsey, he recommends contributing the minimum percentage of your gross income into your 401k that's required to get the full employer match, because it's free money. So you definitely want to do that. And then what you want to do, and I think this is the big take home. There's two things. I could have boiled his entire presentation down to 30 seconds. Two things. The first one is, inquire with your 401k provider and see if you can have your account unlocked, which means that you'll be allowed to invest in whatever stocks or funds you choose to instead of the limited options that they offer. All right, so you want to contact them, contact the administrator, and say, I would like to unlock my 401k account. I would like to just have access to whatever funds are out there. I just like to buy whatever I want. Now, they'll tell you, oh, you shouldn't do that. Oh, you could lose everything. Oh, you go out there, you start buying stuff, or you could lose everything. Of course, you can't lose it. Well, you could. If you invested in Enron in 1993 or something, yeah, you could lose everything. But chances are, if you buy the S&P, you are not going to lose everything. There is pretty much zero chance, except for like nuclear holocaust or something, that the 500 most valuable companies in the United States are going to go to zero, right? I mean, you're not ever going to lose everything. Obviously, that's just hyperbole and fear tactics. But they say, oh, you could lose everything. Well, just tell them, I understand. I'm a big boy. Don't worry about me. I appreciate your concern, though. So ask if you can unlock your account. And you may have to talk to a manager. You may have to, but if you can unlock your account, that's great. Because you could still just invest in the funds that they provide you in the 401k. You could still do just what's available there, but you could also do other things. Okay, so get that account unlocked if you can. This is what Carlton says. Do the same thing before opening up a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA. So when you open up an IRA, shop around and make sure that if I get an IRA that you can just buy whatever you want. You can buy individual stocks, you can buy ETFs, you can buy mutual funds, you can buy whatever. You're not just limited to whatever that company's little list of mutual funds is. Only open up an IRA, traditional or Roth, if you can unlock it or if it's already unlocked, where you can do whatever you want in there. Now, inside your unlocked 401k or IRA of your or your individual brokerage account, remember I already talked about that, your Charles Schwab, Fidelity, E-Trade, whatever. Inside those accounts, this is what Carlton says to do, and it's the simplest thing in the world. Buy the S&P 500. Buy the S&P 500. That's it. You make one buy, and of course you're doing this, every 2 weeks. You buy one thing for the rest of your life and never touch it and never sell it until you retire. Literally, that's what he recommends. Now, how many of you have heard of the S&P 500? Well, of course you did. I just told you about it. So I got ahead of myself in the sermon. So, okay, you've heard about it. How many of you know what it is? Well, of course you should. I just told you what it was. But I'll read you from Wikipedia about what it is. The Standard & Poor's 500, or simply the S&P 500, is a stock market index tracking the stock performance of 500 leading companies listed on stock exchanges in the United States. It is one of the most commonly followed equity is another name for stocks, most commonly followed equity indices, and includes approximately 80% of the total market capitalization of the US public companies, with an aggregate market cap of more than $49.8 trillion as of March 31st, 2025. So, in other words, it's got about 80%, well, it doesn't have 80% of the companies, but it has 80% of the net worth of all the companies in the United States are in that S&P 500. What that means is, though, of all of the thousands and thousands and thousands of companies in the country, 500 of them are worth 80% of the entire U.S. economy. So, and that's what's in the S&P 500. The S&P 500 has averaged about 10 to 12% return over its history since 1926. Here's another quote from Wikipedia on the S&P 500. Since its inception in 1926, it'll take over 100 years next year. Since its inception in 1926, the index's compound annual growth rate, including dividends, think about that as interest that a company pays you if you own its stock. So if you own a stock, you can profit by the stock price going up and selling that stock. But if you own a dividend-paying stock, they actually pay you money every month or every year for owning the stock, right? So you get paid for owning the stock. You get a share, basically, of the profit of the company in addition to whatever the actual stock price may appreciate. Anyway, The growth rate, including dividends, has been approximately 9.8%, 6% after inflation, with the standard deviation of the return over the same period being 20.81%. While the index has declined in several years by over 30%, it has posted annual increases 70% of the time, with 5% of all trading days resulting in record highs. This is why if you go this route, you buy it and you don't sell. Because, yeah, it goes down 30% sometimes. And what most people do, and this is investor psychology, what most people do is buy high and sell low. That's a good way to get poor. But that's what most people do. They see, hey, the S&P's at record highs. Man, people are making crazy money. They go out and buy the S&P. All of a sudden, something happens. You go into a bear market. The S&P goes down 30%. They're like, this thing's going down. I got to get out. Idiot. You just bought at the high and sold at the low. You just lost all that money. What you should do is buy at the low and sell at the high. Of course, it's impossible to buy the low and sell the high. But when you see the market crashing and it's going way down, instead of thinking, I'm scared, I'm getting out of here, think I'm getting in. I'm buying. This is the time to buy. When things are going down, especially after they've gone down for a while, that's the time to buy. Now you'll buy and it'll keep going down for a while, usually. But then it'll start going back up again if history is anything to base it on. Here's from, this is from a little note on the investment calculator at Ramsey Solutions. It says, historically, the 30-year return average of the S&P 500 has been roughly 10 to 12%. And there is a chart there you can click on that link, and I got the link here in the outline. You can click and you can see the chart showing the historical returns of the S&P compared to other stocks and bonds and gold. And you can see what it's done in the last 100 years. Every year you see what it was, how much percentage it was up or down versus these other stocks, bonds, gold, and so on. I'll talk about gold later on. That'll be next Sunday. I won't get to that today. Now, you think, okay, I unlock my 401k and I buy the S&P. But how do I do that? How do I buy the S&P, so to speak? It's very easy to do today using index funds such as mutual funds or exchange-traded funds, ETFs. Now, there are some mutual funds. There may even be one in your 401k. I don't know. There are some mutual funds that track the S&P. They've got the same companies in the same proportions in their fund as the S&P 500 does. So if you bought that fund, it'd be just like buying the S&P. It'd be like buying all those companies in the same proportions. Same thing with ETFs. And this article here, or this quote that I'll give you, will give you some of those ETFs. This is from Wikipedia again on the S&P 500. Index funds, including mutual funds and exchange-traded funds, ETFs, can replicate, before fees and expenses, the performance of the index by holding the same stocks as the index in the same proportions. ETFs that replicate the performance of the index are issued by the Vanguard Group, that's ticker symbol VOO, iShares, that's ticker symbol IVV, and State Street Corporation, and that's ticker symbol SPY or SPLG. The most liquid based on average daily volume is the SPY, although SPY has a higher annual expense ratio of 0.09% compared to 0.03% for VOO and IVV and 0.02% for SPLG. So what they're basically saying is the SPY, it costs, the fund managers take a little bit more money out of that. So you're going to pay a little bit more to own that. I mean, it's not, it's like I said, it's less than 0.1%, but it, you know, you're still going to pay a little bit more to own that one. Mutual funds that track the index are offered by Fidelity Investments, T. Rowe Price, and Charles Schwab Corporation. So you can buy the S&P by simply buying shares of one of those ETFs that replicate it, such as ticker symbol VOO, IVV, or SPY. So you just go into your 401k or your IRA that's unlocked, and you buy those ticker symbols. And when you do it, when you've done so, you bought the S&P. And if you go into Google Finance and you punch in VOO, IVV, or SPY, and then do a compare to and click and select S&P 500, you'll see those charts look exactly the same. They're going to be like the exact same line almost. They're going to follow each other perfectly. That's what they do. They follow the S&P. Now, this is not just Carlton Moore's idea. There is some poor schlub named Warren Buffett out there that doesn't know a thing about investing, but he has the same idea. Of course, I speak in jest. He's considered by many the greatest investor of all time. He recommends that people just buy the S&P. That's what he says. Here's a quote from an article called Warren Buffett's Golden Advice. S&P 500 index funds reign supreme for retirement success. This is from Google Finance from January of last year. Quote, consistently buying an S&P 500 low-cost index fund, Buffett said in 2017. Wait a second. I don't know if that's exact. Anyway, let me read it again. Okay, that's what it was. I said buying and the sentence didn't make sense to me. Okay, let me read it again. Consistently buy an S&P 500 low-cost index fund, Buffett said in 2017. Keep buying it through thick and thin, and especially through thin. This is what he says. This is what he recommends to normal people out there. Just buy the S&P fund. Buy it through thick and thin. Buy it when it's up. Buy it when it's down, especially when it's down. And just keep buying it. And just keep holding on to it. Here's another quote. He says, I recommend the S&P 500 index fund and have for a long, long time to people. Billionaire investor Warren Buffett said at Berkshire Hathaway's annual shareholders meeting last May. So that's what Buffett recommends. Just buy the S&P. Because the S&P 500 beats most so-called professional financial experts, money managers, and financial advisors. Most of them cannot keep up with the S&P 500. This is what Carlton said. He said that 90% of money managers fail to beat the market, i.e. to get a better return in the long run, over the long run, than the S&P 500. And Yahoo Finance, I found, reports close to the same thing. Here's a quote again from that same article in Yahoo Finance. In a report published last month, S&P Dow Jones Indices and analysts found that 85.1% of U.S. large cap equity fund managers underperformed the S&P 500 in 2021. It was the 12th straight year that more than half of the managers in this category lagged the index. In other words, investors following Buffett's advice have outperformed most professional money managers every year for more than a decade. So literally, some dummy like you and I, who don't know a thing, we can go into that account and buy the S&P. We're the stupidest people in the world. We don't even know how to spell stock market. And we beat the so-called experts most of the time. I mean, it's a no-brainer. If you believe in the U.S. market, if you think the U.S. market's the place to be, it's a no-brainer. Buy the S&P. That's what I've come to realize, anyway. That's if you believe the market's, if you believe the U.S. market's going to crash and never come back, well, then don't buy the S&P. And I've already said this part. So, yeah, just before choosing a mutual fund in your 401k or your IRA, go to Google Finance, enter the ticker symbol, do a compare to with the S&P, see how it's performed against it. So like I said, buying the S&P and holding for the long term is the easiest way to invest your retirement money. If the S&P continues to do what it has done historically, you will do well over time. If it does what it's done historically, 10% year over year on average, some years you're going to get negative 30, some years you're going to get positive 70 or 100 or whatever, but on average, you get 10% over the course of, many, many years. But like I said, if you think the U.S. stock market and the economy are going to crash and never recover, then buying the S&P or mutual funds in the U.S. stock market is probably not going to be your choice. So it just depends on, what your outlook is on things. And there was a time, I wish I would have heard this advice. If I would have heard this advice and just done this years ago, I'd have way, way, way more money than I have right now. But I was listening to another fellow, which I'll talk about next Sunday, Peter Schiff, and I still think he's right about a lot of stuff, but he was way early, I think, and I was listening to him. So when the market crashed, you know, in 2009, I think the Dow went down to like 6,000 or something like that. And then it started to come back. And a few years later, it was at like 12,000. And I'm gloom and doom, where I'm thinking, oh man, that market's going to crash again. You know, the real crash is coming. Time to get out. Took my 401k, sold out of, you know, pulled out of everything in the mutual funds and in the U.S. market. And at the time, you know, gold had been going up and up and up, and it was getting into the mainstream. And there was an Oppenheimer gold fund in my 401k. Well, I know what I'll do. I'll put 100%, instead of just putting some, I'll put 100% into that gold fund, because this is what, you know, the gold market's going to go up. The gold mining companies are going to go up, which they did, and they are, and they will continue to, I think. But they took a lot longer than it appeared. They went into a bear market instead of a bull market for a long time. So I jumped out at 12,000, jumped into the gold market when it was relatively high, and then the U.S. stock market went up and up and up and up and up for years and years and years, and the gold market went down, 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 and flat, flat, flat. And now it's coming back. I mean, it's high, and gold's really high now, $3,300 an ounce. And so I think it's a good time to invest in gold mining stocks, which I'll talk about next week, right now at this moment. But anyway, if I would have just known this information and just forgot all that stuff and just bought the S&P, I'd be so much better off right now. But anyway, hindsight's 20/20. But now, maybe Schiff was right all along, and maybe this is not the time to buy the S&P. That's going to be up for you to make that kind of decision. But I'll talk about some other investment areas that you can invest in next Sunday. Lord willing, I didn't get as far as I thought I would, but that's all right. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention anyway, and next week we'll pick it up again and try to finish off this investment section.